You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's show...
A hasty withdrawal would create a vacuum that terrorists, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda, would instantly fill, just as happened before September 11th.
Donald Trump has announced his new strategy on how to deal with the war in Afghanistan. My guests, Jeffrey Howard and Stephen Diel, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the latest revelations over exactly what kind of a Brexit the British government apparently wants, and Russia's announcement that it has finally paid off the rest of the debt it inherited from the Soviet Union. All that, plus how many political parties is too many for a nation. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests today are Jeffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London, and Stephen Diel, writer, broadcaster and Russia analyst. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you with us. Let's start today with the speech Donald Trump gave last night. As expected, he outlined a strategy for the war in Afghanistan and revealed that, unlike what he'd suggested during the presidential campaign, he would not pull out the US forces from the country. He argued a hasty US withdrawal from Afghanistan would leave a vacuum for terrorists to fill. As we've heard, the president of Afghanistan has welcomed the strategy, but as may have been expected, some of Trump's supporters are perhaps a little disappointed. Jeffrey, perhaps I'll come to you first of all. It's quite extraordinary hearing that little clip of Trump at the top of the programme, yet another vault fast from what he said on the campaign trail when people made that point that it would cause instability and he said, no, 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 the time to end it is now. What exactly has happened? Is this the moment when Trump learned to listen vis-a-vis foreign policy? Or is it the usual story, which is Trump doing what is politically expedient on the day to sort of win the headlines just of that 24-hour period?
I think it was a strikingly somber speech that the president gave, and it seems to be evidence that he really is starting to take seriously the gravity of the post. I am skeptical of the idea that this is just for political expediency, though I do think it helps him politically to change the subject from the Charlottesville comments to this topic. No, it seems that Donald Trump has really listened to his generals, has listened to the chief of staff, John Kelly, whose son died in Afghanistan, and perhaps has heard the message that after so many lives have been lost, so much blood and treasure spilled, are we really going to leave now and risk doing what perhaps leaving Iraq did, which was open up a void for organizations like IS to flourish? We know that IS is in Afghanistan, and undoubtedly the IS influence in Afghanistan would only grow if the Americans left. So, no, I think this is one issue in which I think the president might actually be moved by actual concern for the lives of real people.
Pretty extraordinary, Stephen. A more sober tone, you know, a mindful of the needs, the feelings of other people, and maybe possibly, or is this too much to hope, mindful of the fact that, you know, he has an eye on what a potential Trump legacy could look like.
I have to admit, I'm rather more sceptical.
You do surprise me.
My reaction when I heard it was, oh, here he goes again, just, you know, playing to the audience, ignoring completely what he said before. But although it's true, you know, a pullout would leave chaos. But unfortunately, sadly, that's been the situation in Afghanistan for most of the last 40 years. I mean, I remember very well when Soviet troops went in at the end of December 1979, and the so-called military experts, that's a little unkind, the military experts in the West saying, ooh, you know, they haven't learnt the lessons of history. You know, the British got their bottoms whacked in Afghanistan all those years ago, and it's going to happen to them. And, of course, it did happen to them, and they pulled out after not quite 10 years. And there was then years later, I remember that a former American army officer saying to me, do you realize we've just passed that mark where we've been in Afghanistan longer than the Soviet Union was, and no one's really said anything about it? It is one of those, It's a cliche, but it is, I think, one of those unwinnable wars. So whether they pull out now or whether they carry on for a bit longer, obviously with much lower manpower than they had at the peak of about 2010. And in 2010, I think it's something like 100,000 American troops. But even so, I just find it very difficult to see any positive outcome. You know, whenever they pull out, the trouble is going to continue. Am I being too pessimistic?
And with that spectre, I mean, people have said, haven't they, Jeffrey, about, you know, barbarians at the gate around Kabul and so on and so forth, and the difficulty of trying to engage with Pakistan, of course, another key stakeholder in this. But should we, if we follow your more upbeat reading of the situation, should we at least not celebrate, but make note of the fact that Trump appears to have paid heed to the generals once again? Because we've seen Bannon's departure in the last week. We've seen fewer of those maybe more extreme voices in his sort of retinue, his inner circle. Are we finally reaching the point where the White House staff is peopled by, you know, politicians, military men, people who can make expedient and sensible strategic decisions?
I mean, I think the fact that the White House is populated by military men is surely part of why Trump has arrived at this conclusion. You know, to he with a hammer, every problem is a nail. And the I think while we probably should welcome the fact that Trump seems to be approaching this issue with a degree of gravity and seriousness in contrast to other issues that he's focused on, I don't think it's obvious that staying in Afghanistan and increasing these troop levels by this amount is the right thing to do. Is this the requisite degree of commitment that will actually stabilize Afghanistan? Or is this a minor increase that is certainly desired by the Pentagon at this time, but actually isn't going to make much of a difference? I think it's reasonable to expect America and its allies to do something to stabilize Afghanistan. But at a certain point, we have to realize that our duty is not to make Afghanistan stable. Our duty is to put in a reasonable effort to make Afghanistan stable. Mm-hmm. And the fact that in 2 years, we'll have men and women fighting Afghanistan who were not born on 9/11. That's unbelievable. We'll have to ask ourselves, have we put in a reasonable effort? Now, I think some people would say that the battle in Afghanistan has been so incompetently fought or poorly fought that we can't say that we've made a reasonable effort. But I think it's at least plausible after all this time to say that we have and that we might have to wrap up and go home.
Can I play the devil's advocate again, though, and say, should we perhaps take a pause on this one and see what Trump says next week about this? You know, he does have a reputation already for saying, well, I mean, Charlottesville was the sadly the perfect example where, you know, he didn't criticize the outright. Then apparently he did. Then the next day he didn't. Blamed everyone for it. You know, I wouldn't take this as a definite foreign policy statement that by the time that Trump leaves office, whenever that might be, that there will still be the same policy on Afghanistan. Maybe I'm being, again, too skeptical. But
I think in terms of his vault faces, I don't know. Charlottesville felt like, well, I don't know whether, is it the zenith or the nadir of that, Jeffrey?
Yeah.
On the broader point, though, about the reliance potentially on the military men, and that's certainly something he's been reasonably consistent about, do you have any unease about that? I mean, some people have said, look, you know, if you were to paint a picture of a White House administration where, you know, the key decision makers, the eminent squeeze, if you like, behind the throne, you know, were all military men and all the other lay persons were gone, you'd say, well, this is a White House that's heading in a really weird direction. And it's funny, I don't know, I sort of look at this from a rather conflicted point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he said in the speech that, you know, we're not nation building again, we are killing terrorists. And that can't be right. Obviously, the purpose is to create the security conditions for political and economic development and to help participate in political economic development. I mean, this is one of the objections to the Afghan war, that the military has been engaged in all sorts of activities that the military isn't particularly good at doing, and that we haven't done enough to involve non-military actors in development efforts in Afghanistan. No, I think we're right to be concerned about using military personnel in this context. And to Stephen's point, I think that he's probably right that we should wait and see. Trump is good at one thing in particular, which is throwing people under the bus. When something goes south, he will look for someone to blame. And these generals will be blamed if he's up for re-election in a few years. And, you know, perhaps he'll still be president in a few years. And if he's up for re-election and Afghanistan is going really, really poorly, he's not going to take responsibility for that.
But also this idea of killing terrorists, you know, that is the main aim. Also, history shows us that terrorist organizations are often like the Hydra, cut off one head and two grow in its place. You know, just killing terrorists doesn't wipe out a terrorist organization.
I just wonder also with Trump, and perhaps before we move on, this is going to be the final thought on this. if he inadvertently arrives at, even in the short term, strategic decisions that seem to be correct or acceptable, does it matter, in your view, if he doesn't understand it? You've said there the primary objective is killing terrorists, which is in opposition to what he's actually announcing. Does it matter if he doesn't understand it? Because let's be fair, he's probably not going to understand much nuance when it comes to foreign policy.
Well, what's ironic about this is that for all the concern about the so-called deep state that Trump and Bannon and other allies other Trump supporters have talked about, this demonstrates exactly that. When the president isn't in firm command of the policy details of a given question, the decision-making will just be outsourced to the people around him. And if the generals were going to Trump and saying, you know what, Afghanistan's a terrible idea, we should leave, he'd probably be saying we should leave. And one thing that certainly came out of discussions from Obama aides is that Obama was very, very concerned to get to the truth. And he had his own view about things and he'd push back against people when they disagreed with him. It's not clear in this issue that Trump is doing that.
Indeed. Let's move on and cross the Atlantic. The UK has this week released more papers which reveal, hopefully, some aspects of what kind of a Brexit it apparently wants to achieve. What's been pointed out is that now it seems the British government very much wants to, well, rather maintain the status quo. There are only three areas where it wants major change. The ECJ must have no say in UK affairs, freedom of movement must end, and Britain must be able to strike its own trade deals. Now, it's already been pointed out by some analysts that this rather sounds like cherry picking, which is precisely what Brussels had and had continued to warn the UK against. Stephen, it doesn't feel like we've gone very far from that Brexit vote if this is the conflict. Britain saying, well, we'd like these nice things, we don't want these troublesome things. How does that sound?
Oh dear, if I'm sceptical about Trump, I'm even more sceptical about leaving the EU. I hate using that awful B word. The thing I keep coming back to is, and indeed, for example, the Irish Prime Minister has already said, you know, that they want to have their cake and eat it. Well, they're not going to. This is a divorce. And only one side wants to divorce. Now, in any case of a divorce where only one side wants it, the other side doesn't tend to let the one that wants the divorce have it all their own way. You know, and often there is an element of revenge. And whatever the other EU leaders say, you know, they are bitter and bitterly disappointed about Britain leaving the EU. And I can't see them letting Britain cherry-pick what
they
want.
Well, they have their
own
existential concerns, which will remain after that happens.
Of course, of course. And freedom of movement is a crucial one. It's one that worries me. It worries a lot of people in this country. You know, we have so many Europeans who work here now, and it's... Yeah, we're in London, and I live in London, and in London, you know, London voted to stay in. Maybe we should become a city-state within the EU.
I have mooted this before, Stephen, in fact.
And this is, I think we really do feel it. And when you do go out to other parts of England in particular, I've been to test the water and find actually that, you know, people who don't see a black face, who don't see a foreign, the only people they see are Poles who they mistrust because they come and taking the jobs of the local builders and this sort of thing. So, yes, there is, you know, we are a divided society. But we're not going to get it all our own way. And to come back to your initial point, yeah, this really worries me. I know this for a fact, that when that vote took place on the 23rd of June last year, there was no policy in place as to what would happen if it was a no vote. They didn't even allow, the government had said to the civil servants, you are not to draw up any plans because if you did, they might be leaked and then it would look bad. So, they woke up, or if they hadn't even gone to bed probably, on the 24th of June, and suddenly it was, oh, what do we do now? They really were starting from scratch on the 24th of June. But that's been more than a year. And as you rightly say, Tom, where are they? There is this feeling that they really haven't got a grip on this and they haven't presented any realistic proposals.
Jeff, you've been striking optimistic notes throughout. Could there be some truth to this idea that we're keeping our hands, the British here, close to our chest, and that this is all a sort of a front, a mirage, and actually we have better ideas and more conciliatory discussions that are sort of in process?
I agree that it's a front for something, but I don't think it's a front for better ideas. I think it's a front for probably quite deep disagreement within the cabinet about what's going to happen, about what Brexit ideally looks like. I mean, do you remember that memo that was photographed by in the hands of an aide outside Downing Street last November, where he wrote, "Have cake and eat it," and the government
it seems they're still working from that document.
And all the government agents, all the officials denied that this actually captured the government policy. They said, "We have no idea where this memo came from," but it looks like this is actually the government's position. And of course, why wouldn't it be? It's obviously strategically rational to say, I want all the good things, I want all the benefits without any of the burdens and responsibilities. We even have a term for that. It's called free riding. And we think it's morally wrong, right? We think it's morally wrong to demand the benefits of a cooperative arrangement without doing our fair share, doing our responsibilities. Mm. We wouldn't accept it within our society. That's why all of us condemn tax cheats and people don't pay their own way or pay their fair share. But we should also condemn it when it happens between countries too. And that, I think, is the most important objection to what the UK government is pressing for. They're pressing for an unfair deal. They're pressing for a deal that would give Britain all these benefits paid for through the cooperation of European countries without saddling their fair share of the responsibility. And that's deeply morally wrong. And Theresa May and her government should be called out for peddling a deeply morally objectionable policy.
And if that weren't bad enough, it seems to have taken us however many months already to get to the position where that still manifestly seems to be the case. How has that happened? And what does Brussels make of it? Are they thinking, well, to be honest, this merely increases the chance of the UK getting a terrible deal? And frankly, that'll be a good lesson to the others? I mean, I just wonder what this looks like from the other side of that narrow body of water on the continent.
There was this intriguing statement by David Davis the other day in a piece he wrote in which he floated the idea that the UK might have ongoing bills paid to the EU with respect to programs we want to participate in. So it's like even he is recognizing the possibility that we're not going to get away with this unless we keep paying something. I still think it's possible that what we wind up with at the end of the day looks very close to membership in the EU with all the responsibilities and burdens that involves.
Well, and this was the point I was going to turn back to you, Stephen, and I'm sure it's a question, and at risk of repeating myself, as I possibly have done over the last 18 months or so, is there a chance here that this all, it's all too complicated, the deals are all too weak, that we either end up with a deal precisely as has been described that's very much like what we have now, or simply that the whole thing doesn't move forward and we end up just hanging on in there and we don't leave at all?
Either could happen, or we could have Europe getting the rest of the EU getting so fed up with Britain that they effectively kick us out with no deal at all, and we are up the proverbial stream without a paddle.
It was interesting to reflect on that point with your divorce analogy about there can be vindictiveness. Mm-hmm. Brussels doesn't want to see that, does it? Because that everybody does lose under that. I mean, Britain is the worst off, but that's surely not a good longer term solution.
It's not good, but you know, if it comes to that stage where we do seem to be wanting to have our cake and eat it, and Brussels saying, well, you know, hang on, look, you know, you've joined, you know, member of the club, you pay your dues and so on. I think that, you know, there is, if you see certain politicians, and I'm trying to think who it was, I saw now, and I'm sorry, the name escapes me, a European politician who was asked, you know, do you think something about the British? He was doorstepped as a journalist, saying he was stopped going into a meeting. do you think that the British position is viable or is changing? And he just said nope, stormed off. And I think, you know, there is this danger, and it is a danger that, you know, if Theresa May and her team or whoever is in place of Theresa May by then sticks to March 2019 and saying right, that's it, that's when we're leaving the EU, and no deal has been agreed, then, you know, we could be just cut off and then having to run around and try and make all these amazing trade deals which we're supposed to be doing with the rest of the world, which again there will be warnings. I mean, the Theresa May's visit to India was a very good sign of that, you know, sort of going to India and saying, you know, well, we have a great history and tradition with you and you're going to do lots of trade, and the Indians basically said, well, no, you know, we don't really need you. I fear for the future on this, because as far as I'm concerned, the best deal would be actually that we back down, and whether it's through another referendum or whatever, that there is, you know, somehow we are hanging in there, and we keep our wonderful European friends and colleagues who work here, and we don't put stupid restrictions on them. We allow Britons to carry on who want to work on the continent to work on the continent, and you know, somehow we muddle through. But it will be muddling through. I mean, the whole thing has been a complete disaster, as far as I'm concerned.
Wise words, I would say. And the political class in this country hasn't exactly covered itself in glory, which prompts me to ask our next question, which is, how many political parties does a country actually need? I feel maybe a good few more in this country would be the order of the day. But maybe Brazil's gone rather too far, and setting a slightly extreme example with its 35 parties. And just over the past year, there have been more than 60 trying to get an official status that would allow them to put forward candidates for office. Some of the new parties hoping to gain wider popularity include the Sports Party, which demands more gymnasiums. I think we can all get on board with that. Brazilian Military Party, which wants to privatise prisons, among other things, going in a slightly strange direction. And my personal favourite, the Animals Party, which is from Nicole Puzzi, a porn star from the 70s, who's now one of 100 vegans who's launched the party that wants to equate animals' legal status with that of children. Just to give you a bit of the background. Perhaps, Jeffrey, I can come to you. We come in with from two countries, the UK, or if we look over to, you know, the United States, for example, very much this tradition of, you know, two-party systems. The whole thing is more fragmented now. It also seems to be more polarised. Is the answer a more granular political spectrum?
I'm quite sceptical of the idea that we want a society that has lots and lots of political parties like this. So I think we need to step back and ask ourselves what we think political parties are for. And I think the role of a political party is to articulate a holistic view of what the common good is of a particular society and defend that view as the right view for the society, and then to try to mobilize political support for that view so that they can then get into office and implement it, right? And these can pull against each other, right? If you think you have the right political philosophy, but it's really unpopular or you're really bad at selling it, you might not get much support, and that pushes against the idea that you want to mobilize support. But I think that striking a balance between these two things, getting to the truth of how you want to organize society and then getting people to agree with you so you can actually implement that your view of the truth or something close to it, is the role of a political party. And excessively small political parties, I think, do a bad job of fulfilling that idea of the purpose of a political party. Partly because if they're really small, they can't seriously gain political power, so they fail to mobilize support. They tend to fail to offer a holistic vision of society, right? They focus on these piecemeal policy issues rather than a big picture view of what the principles are that should govern the society. And then finally, I think small political parties have a risk of deteriorating into factions, which don't purport to offer a view of what the just or good or right policy is, but are just defending the special interests of a particular group. And at that point, they fail to actually qualify as a proper political party, or they fail to live up to what I think the purpose of a political party should be. So while I think the system could certainly tolerate maybe a couple more political parties, I think going down the route of Brazil would be a serious mistake.
Keep it definitely under three figures.
That's right.
See, that's an interesting point, isn't it, that Jeffrey makes there? And I'm particularly struck by that idea that implementation needs to be part of your program. Because if we look at the UK political spectrum, you've got many who support Jeremy Corbyn, for example, who say, you know, this is a man who's sticking to his principles. And yet it's fairly clear he's not going to trouble number 10. So if there's no chance of implementing that, though, let's be fair, the Tories have made it actually slightly more likely, that you're not fulfilling one of, I mean, as Jeffrey would define it, one of the key functions of being a political power and a political party.
Yeah, I mean, if as we've been talking about our own system and situation in the UK, you know, and Theresa May trying to solve the mess that Brexit brought about, decided to have an election and made even more of a mess. I love the line, though, that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn showed that all those people who said he would never be elected to number 10, he proved them wrong by not being elected to number 10. So, yes, he got more votes. But I think I would go so far as to say it's a tragedy in this country that we don't have a strong party of the centre, particularly now, particularly when the Brexit vote did show that the country is deeply divided. On all sorts of levels, and you know, perhaps what we need is a common sense centre party. There is the Liberal Democrats. They didn't do well at all this time or last time. Unfortunately, they're still tainted with sharing power in the coalition government. So, yes, you know, our two-party system is showing cracks that are not easily going to be papered over. But this, the Brazilian situation, Brazil perhaps might look to Russia, if I can bring in Russia at this point, because I remember covering the 1995 elections for the Duma, the Russian parliament, where there were 43 parties on the ballot paper. And it's exactly as Jeffrey was saying, unfortunately, what you get is that they fracture the vote, and so you get one or two big parties coming through, and they tend to be the ones that have all the money, and of course and there was a lot of corruption, and people held big events and spent loads of money, and then the Russian Electoral Commission said, oh no, they hadn't spent the money, when quite clearly they had, and the little parties then take away votes from each other. The Russians say they have an expression. They say that they sprung up like mushrooms after the rain. That's because Russians are great mushroom pickers. And so you get lots of these little parties, and they don't really mean anything. And they have these tiny single focus issues, and a few people will vote for them. And it really doesn't help the political situation. And now, of course, in Russia, it's very different. You've effectively gone back to a one party state, which it was in communist times. So I don't know the Brazilian situation intimately, but it does seem absurd to have so many parties, because you need some sort of consensus in politics. Yes, you need an opposition, but you need compromise as well. And it's very difficult to compromise when you've got 35, 43, 72, however many parties it's going to be. Particularly if you then get the situation, which, if I may quote from Life of Brian, known to many people, where, you know, excuse me, are you the Judean People's Front? No, we're not. I paraphrase there. He's sitting over there. Split. You see that is such a wonderful parody of what happens with when political parties just splinter off and over tiny little differences. And I really can't see that you can run a country terribly effectively with that many political parties.
Well, and Jeffrey, that was before we move on. That was what people always said to me when I was studying politics when I was younger, was that you don't get things done. It's more secure. It's more it's a more predictable, in a good way political system if you have results driven elections and this sort of thing. But doesn't the politics at the moment, it's more polarized, it's more divisive? Couldn't we use a bit of a more conciliatory, maybe even coalition approach? Wouldn't that be a good thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it goes back to this balance between identifying a view of how you want to organize your society, but not being so dogmatic about the particular details of your view, 10 spaces to the right of the decimal point, that you refuse to huddle together with people who are close enough to your view that you can recognize them as political and moral allies.
Now, Stephen, you cast the sort of historical eye back to Russia a moment ago, and I want to do that more now. Russia, we have learned, has announced it's repaid the last of the country's Soviet-era debt. It transferred some $125 million to Bosnia and Herzegovina earlier this month. What, a quarter of a century odd, Stephen. Is this a good accomplishment? Is it the sort of thing we should celebrate? I imagine there's quite a lot of nuance to this kind of thing.
There is. I don't know if it's a question of celebrating. It's probably more of a relief, both to the Bosnians, Herzegovins, and to the Russians, that that is now out of the way. But in all seriousness, we need to look back to what happened when the Soviet Union collapsed. Well, first of all, it happened largely peacefully, without the awful civil war, which some predicted and could well have happened. So that was the good news. But then there was an awful lot of detail that had to be taken apart. Oh, it sounds rather like leaving the EU. you had suddenly 15 independent countries. You had their relations with the rest of the world. And actually, one of the simplest solutions, and I would suggest it's worked, was that basically Russia, as obviously the biggest individual country of the former Soviet states, said, look, we will take on all the debt, but we will also, as a result, the plus side will be we will have the assets of things like, so the embassies, all the embassies around, all the Soviet embassies became Russian embassies. So the individual countries that had come out of the Soviet Union said, there were some disagreements with Georgia and the Baltic states, but other than that, all the others said, yeah, okay, that suits us. Any property that was on their territory, so factories in Ukraine or Georgia or Kazakhstan or wherever, they became the property of that country. But in terms of the foreign assets, the Russians said, right, we'll have the embassies and other property, but we'll take on the debt. And it was one of the simplest solutions to what was a very complicated situation. And yes, it's taken 25 years to pay off the final debt. And I found it quite amusing in that, you know, 125 million is not a great sum of money for a country the size of Russia, even in current economic circumstances. But it's funny it's taken this long to pay it off. But it draws a line under one particular point of history. But there was a logic to, and a surprisingly simple logic to the whole thing.
And Jeffrey, it's interesting, isn't it, to reflect on that? And I wonder that sort of debt level wouldn't have, you know, hamstrung Russia, one imagines, in the years since. But nevertheless, it hangs around maybe like a bad smell. But it is interesting because often post-conflict, you have huge restructuring of debt and a shifting of obligations. But this does seem like a story where it's been handled rather sensibly, and it was structured in such a way that it was realistic. And yeah, maybe this is something of a marker. Should a future scenario in any way similar to that unfold?
I think that might be right. I mean, it certainly raises the question of what the relationship is between contemporary Russia and its Soviet past. And I think different Russians have very different views about what the relationship is between its current state of affairs, between the current state of affairs and the Soviet past. And things like this help to put a book in it, put a pin in it.
Now, time is short, but I wanted to very briefly ask you, gentlemen, for your opinions about Ryanair. It's called for a limit on how much passengers are allowed to preload, I assume that's their terminology, at departure lounges before they board their flights. Two drinks only at the airport, no alcohol sales before 10 a.m. In a word or two, and I do mean that because time is short, Stephen, are you an advocate of the early morning pint or pints at an airport?
No, I've flown quite a bit recently, and I've seen people drinking. I had got a flight at 8 o'clock in the morning recently, and the guy next to me ordered a bottle of wine and a cider, and I thought, oh dear me, I don't want to.
It's going to be a long, flight.
Yeah, fortunately, he kept himself to himself.
Jeffrey, in a word or two, is this something you'd welcome?
So I think the issue is it rational for a passenger to accept a reduced quantity of alcohol in the airport in return for greater safety on the airplane? And I think the answer to that is yes.
There we go. We're solving all the big problems of the world in just in a sentence or two. So elegantly done, as always. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. That's Jeffrey Howard and Stephen Diel, our guests today on Midori House. The programme was produced by Marco Sippi, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sophia Amadi. And our studio manager was Christy Evans. My thanks to all of them. More music for you next. 1900, it's Section D, our design programme. And we'll have more on all the big news stories of the day on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 London time. We're back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. My name's Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.